The next day, the women were gathered on straw mats under the shade of a mango tree, while Granny braided Alma's hair and Zaituni braided the hair of a neighbor's girl. Sitting down beside them, I asked Granny to tell me about my grandfather, from the beginning. And under the fanning shade of a mango tree, as hands wove black curls into even rows, I heard all our voices beginning to run together. The sound of three generations tumbling over each other like the currents of a slow-moving stream, my questions like rocks roiling the water, the breaks in memories separating the currents, but always the voices returning to that single course, a single story. First, there was Miwiru. It's not known who came before. Miwiru sired Sigoma. Sigoma sired Owini. Owini sired Kisori. Kisori sired Ogelo. Ogelo sired Otondi. Otondi sired Obongo. Obongo sired Okoth. And Okoth sired Opio. The women who bore them, their names are forgotten, for that was the way of our people. Okoth lived in Alego. Before that, it is known only that the families traveled a great distance, from the direction of what is now Uganda, and that we were like the Maasai, migrating in search of water and grazing land for great herds of cattle. In Alego, the people settled and began to grow crops. Once people began to settle and farm, the land in Alego became crowded. Opio, son of Okoth, decided to move to Kendu Bay. When he moved there, he was landless. But in the custom of our people, a man could use any unused land. He worked in the compounds of other men and cleared the land for his own farm. But before he could prosper, he died very young, leaving behind two wives and several children. One wife was taken in by Opio's brother, as was the custom then. She became the brother's wife, her children his children. But the other wife also died, and her oldest son, Obama, was orphaned when still a boy. He too lived with his uncle, but the resources of the family were strained, and so as Obama grew older, he began to work for other men as his father had done before him. The family he worked for was wealthy, with many cattle, but they came to admire Obama, for he was enterprising and a very good farmer. When he sought to marry their oldest daughter, they agreed, and the uncles in this family provided the necessary dowry. And when this eldest daughter died, they agreed that Obama could marry the younger daughter, whose name was Naoki. Eventually, Obama had four wives, who bore him many children. He cleared his own land and became prosperous, with a large compound and many cattle and goats. And because of his politeness and responsible ways, he became an elder in Kindu, and many came to seek his advice. Your grandfather, Onyango, was Nyaoki's fifth son. Even from the time that he was a boy, your grandfather Onyango was strange. He would wander off on his own for many days, and when he returned, he would not say where he had been. He was very serious always. He never laughed or played games with the other children, and never made jokes. He was always curious about other people's business, which is how he learned to be an herbalist. As a boy, your grandfather sat in the hut of the herbalist in his village, watching and listening carefully while the other boys played, and in this way he gained knowledge. When your grandfather was still a boy, we began to hear that the white man had come to Kisumu town. It was said that these white men had skin as soft as a child's, but that they rode on a ship that roared like thunder and had sticks that burst with fire. Before this time, no one in our village had seen white men, only Arab traders who sometimes came to sell us sugar and cloth. But even that was rare, for our people did not use much sugar, and we did not wear cloth, only a goatskin that covered our genitals. When the elders heard these stories, they discussed it among themselves and advised the men to stay away from Kisumu until this white man was better understood. Despite this warning, Onyango became curious and decided that he must see these white men for himself. One day he disappeared, and no one knew where he had gone. Then, many months later, while Obama's other sons were working the land, Onyango returned to the village. He was wearing the trousers of a white man, and a shirt like a white man, and shoes that covered his feet. The small children were frightened, and his brothers didn't know what to make of this change. They called on their father, Obama, who came out of his hut, and the family gathered round to stare at Onyango's strange appearance. "What has happened to you?" Obama asked. "Why do you wear these strange skins?" Onyango said nothing, and Obama decided that Onyango must be wearing trousers to hide the fact that he was circumcised, which was against Luo custom. He thought that Onyango's shirt must be covering a rash or sores. Obama turned to his other sons and said, "Don't go near this brother of yours. He is unclean." Then he returned to his hut, and the others laughed and shunned Onyango. Because of this, Onyango returned to Kisumu, and he would remain estranged from his father for the rest of his life. Things began to change with the first of the white man's wars. During this time, your grandfather worked for the white man. Few people could speak English or Swahili in those days. Men didn't like to send their sons to the white man's school, preferring that they work with them on the land. But Onyango had learned to read and write, and understood the white man's system of paper records and land titles. This made him useful to the white man, and during the war he was put in charge of road crews. Eventually he was sent to Tanganyika, where he stayed for several years. When he finally returned, he cleared land for himself in Kindu, but it was far away from his father's compound, and he rarely spoke to his brothers. He didn't build a proper hut for himself, but instead lived in a tent. People had never seen such a thing, and they thought he was crazy. After he had staked his claim, he traveled to Nairobi, where a white man had offered him a job. He was not the only one who moved to town. After the war, many Africans began working for wages, especially those who had been conscripted, or lived near the cities, or had joined the white missions. Many people had been displaced during and immediately following the war. Your grandfather prospered. In his job in Nairobi, he learned how to prepare the white man's food and organize the white man's house. Because of this, he was popular with employers and worked in the estates of some of the most important white men, even Lord Delamere. He saved his wages and bought land and cattle in Kindu. Finally, he found a wife, a woman named Halima. It is not known how she felt towards your grandfather, but she was quiet and polite, and most important, she could maintain your grandfather's high housekeeping standards. He built a hut for her in Kindu, where she spent most of her time. Sometimes he would bring her to Nairobi to stay in the house where he worked. After a few years had passed, it was discovered that Halima could not bear any children. Among the Luo, this was normally proper grounds for divorce. A man could send a barren wife back to his in-laws and ask that his dowry be returned. But your grandfather chose to keep Halima, and in that sense, he treated her well. Still, it must have been lonely for Halima, for your grandfather worked all the time and had no time for friends or entertainment. He did not drink with other men, and he did not smoke tobacco. His only pleasure was going to the dance halls in Nairobi once a month, for he liked to dance. But he also was not such a good dancer. He was rough and would bump into people and step on their feet. Most people didn't say anything about this because they knew Onyango and his temper. One night, though, a drunken man began to complain about Onyango's clumsiness. The man became rude and told your grandfather, "Onyango, you are already an older man. You have many cattle and you have a wife, and yet you have no children. Tell me, is something the matter between your legs?" People who overheard the conversation began to laugh, and Onyango beat this man severely. But the drunk man's words must have stayed with your grandfather. For that month, he set out to find another wife. He returned to Kindu and inquired about all the women in the village. Finally, he made up his mind on a young girl named Akumu, who was well regarded for her beauty. She was already promised to another man, who had paid her father 6 cattle in dowry, promising to deliver 6 more in the future. But Onyango knew the girl's father, and he convinced him to send back these 6 cattle. In return, Onyango gave him 15 cattle on the spot. By the time I came to live with him, Akumu had already borne Onyango 2 children. The first was Sarah. 3 years later came your father, Barak. I did not know Akumu well, for she and her children lived with Halima on your grandfather's compound in Kindu, while I stayed with him in Nairobi, to help him with his work there. But whenever I accompanied your grandfather to Kindu, I could see that Akumu was unhappy. Halima tried to help Akumu, and cared for the children as if they were her own, but it didn't help. Life became easier for her when the Second World War came. Your grandfather went overseas as the cook to the British captain, and I came to live with Akumu and Halima, helping both with the children and their crops. We did not see Onyango for some time. He traveled widely with the British regiments, to Burma and Ceylon, to Arabia, and to somewhere in Europe. When he returned 3 years later, he came with a gramophone and that picture of the woman he claimed to have married in Burma. Onyango was now almost 50, More and more, he thought of quitting his work for the white man and returning to farm the land. He saw, though, that the land surrounding Kindu was crowded and overgrazed, so his mind went back to Alego, the land that his grandfather had abandoned. One day he came to his wives and told us that we should prepare ourselves to leave for Alego. When we arrived in Alego, most of this land that you see now was bush, and life was hard for all of us. But your grandfather had studied modern farming techniques while in Nairobi, and he put his ideas to work. He could make anything grow, and in less than a year he had grown enough crops to sell at market. He smoothed out the earth to make this wide lawn, and cleared the fields where his crops grew high and plentiful. He planted the mango and banana and pawpaw trees that you see today. He even sold most of his cattle because he said that their grazing made the soil poor and caused it to wash away. With this money, he built large huts for Akumu and myself, and a hut of his own. He had brought back a crystal set from England that he displayed on a shelf, and on his gramophone he played strange music late into the night. When my first children, Omar and Zaituni, were born, he bought them cribs and gowns and separate mosquito nets, just as he had for Barak and Sera. In the cooking hut, he built an oven in which he baked bread and cakes like you buy in a store. His neighbors in Alego had never seen such things. At first they were suspicious of him and thought he was foolish, especially when he sold his cattle. But soon they came to respect his generosity, as well as what he taught them about farming and herbal medicines. Even if Onyango had used one of these medicines on Akumu, I don't think he could have made her happy. No matter how much he beat her, she would argue with him. She was also proud and scornful of me, and often refused to help in the household chores. She had a third child, named Alma, like this one sitting here, and as she nursed this new baby, she secretly planned her escape. One night, when Sarah was 12 and Barak was 9, she made her move. She woke up Sarah and said that she was running away to Kindu. She told Sarah that it was too difficult a journey for children to make at night, but said that they should follow her as soon as they were older. Then she disappeared with her baby into the darkness. When Onyango found out what had happened, he was furious. At first, he thought he should let Akumu go. But when he saw that Barak and Sarah were still young, and that even I, with two children of my own, was little more than a girl, he went to Akumu's family in Kindu and asked that she be returned. But the family refused. They had come to hear how harshly Onyango treated Akumu, and in fact had already accepted a dowry for Akumu's remarriage to another man. Together, Akumu and her new husband had left for Tanganyika. There was nothing Onyango could do, so he returned to Alego. He said to himself, "It does not matter," and he told me that I was now the mother of all his children. Neither he nor I knew of Akumu's last visit to Sarah, but Sarah had remembered her mother's instructions, and only a few weeks passed before she woke up Barak in the middle of the night, just as her mother had done to her. She told Barak to be quiet, helped him get dressed, and together they began to walk down the road to Kindu. I still wonder that they both survived. They were gone for almost 2 weeks, walking many miles each day, hiding from those who passed them on the road, sleeping in fields and begging for food. Not far from Kindu they became lost, and a woman finally saw them and took pity on them, for they were filthy and almost starved. The woman took them in and fed them and asked them their names, and when she realized who they were, she sent for your grandfather. And when Onyango came to get them and saw how badly they looked, this is the only time that anyone ever saw him cry. The children never tried to run away again, but I don't think they ever forgot this journey they made. Sarah kept a careful distance from Onyango, and in her heart remained loyal to Akumu, for she was older and perhaps had seen how the old man had treated her mother. I believe she also resented me for taking her mother's place. Barak reacted differently. He could not forgive his abandonment, and acted as if Akumu didn't exist. He told everyone that I was his mother, and although he would send Akumu money when he became a man, to the end of his life he would always act coldly towards her. The strange thing was that in many ways Sarah was most like her father in personality. Strict, hardworking, easy to anger, whereas Barak was wild and stubborn like Akumu. But of course, such things one does not see in oneself. As you might expect, Onyango was very strict with his children. He worked them hard and would not allow them to play outside the compound because he said other children were filthy and ill-mannered. Whenever Onyango went away, I would ignore these instructions because children must play with other children, just as they must eat and sleep. But I would never tell your grandfather what I did, and I would have to scrub the children clean before your grandfather came home. This was not easy, especially with Barak. That boy was so mischievous. In Onyango's presence, he appeared well-mannered and obedient, and never answered back when his father told him to do something. But behind the old man's back, Barak did as he pleased. When Onyango was away on business, Barak would take off his proper clothes and go off with the other boys to wrestle or swim in the river, to steal the fruit from the neighbors' trees, or ride their cows. The neighbors were afraid to go directly to Onyango, so they would come to me and complain about these things. But I could not get mad at Barak, and would always cover up his foolishness from Onyango, for I loved him as my own son. Although he did not like to show it, your grandfather was also very fond of Barak, because the boy was so clever. When Barak was only a baby, Onyango would teach him the alphabet and numbers, and it was not long before the son could outdo the father in these things. This pleased Onyango, for to him, knowledge was the source of all the white man's power, and he wanted to make sure that his son was as educated as any white man. He was less concerned with Sarah's education, although she was also quick like Barak. Most men thought educating their daughters was a waste of money. This created more friction between Sarah and her younger brother, especially because she knew that Barak was not always serious about his studies. Everything came too easily to him. At first he went to the mission school nearby, but he came back after the first day and told his father that he could not study there because his class was taught by a woman, and he knew everything she had to teach him. This attitude he had learned from his father, so Onyango could say nothing. The next closest school was 6 miles away, and I began to walk him to this school every morning. His teacher there was a man, but Barak discovered this didn't solve his problems. He always knew the answers, and sometimes he would even correct the teacher's mistakes before the whole class. The teacher would scold Barak for his insolence, but Barak would refuse to back down. This caused Barak many canings at the hand of the headmaster. But it also might have taught him something, because the next year, when he switched to a class with a woman teacher, I noticed that he didn't complain. Still, he was bored with school, and when he became older, he would stop going to school altogether for weeks at a time. A few days before exams, he would find a classmate and read through the lessons. He could sit down and teach himself everything in just a few days, and when the marks came in, he would always be first. The few times he didn't come in first, he came to me in tears, for he was so used to being the best. But this happened only once or twice. Usually he would come home laughing and boasting of his cleverness. By the time your father was a teenager, things were rapidly changing in Kenya. People began to talk about independence. Meetings and demonstrations were held, and petitions were presented to the administration complaining about land confiscations and the power of chiefs to commission free labor for government projects. Like other boys, your father would be influenced by the early talk of independence, and he would come home from school talking about the meetings he had seen. Your grandfather agreed with many of the demands of the early parties like KANU, but he remained skeptical that the independence movement would lead to anything because he thought Africans could never win against the white man's army. Despite this attitude, your grandfather would once find himself detained. An African who worked for the district commissioner was jealous of your grandfather's lands. This man had once been rebuked by your grandfather because he would collect excessive taxes and pocket the money for himself. During the emergency, this man placed Onyango's name on a list of KANU supporters and told the white man that Onyango was a subversive. One day, the white man's soldiers came to take Onyango away, and he was placed in a detention camp. Eventually, he received a hearing, and he was found innocent. But he had been in camp for over 6 months, and when he returned to Alego, he was very thin and dirty. He had difficulty walking, and his head was full of lice. He was so ashamed he refused to enter his house or tell us what had happened. Barak was away at the time, and only learned about this detention later. He had taken the district examinations and had been admitted to Maseno Mission School, some 50 miles south. This should have been a great honor for Barak, because few Africans then were allowed to get secondary education, and only the best students got into Maseno. But your father's rebellious nature caused the school much grief. He would sneak girls into his dormitory. He and his friends would raid nearby farms for chickens and yams because they did not like the dormitory food. The teachers at the school overlooked many of these infractions, for they saw how smart he was. But eventually Barak went too far with his mischief and was finally expelled. Onyango was so furious when he found out, he beat Barak with a stick until Barak's back was bleeding. But Barak refused to run or cry out or even explain himself to his father. The following week, Onyango told Barak that he had arranged for him to travel to the coast, where he would work as a clerk. Barak had no choice but to obey his father. He went to Mombasa and took the job, in the office of an Arab merchant. But after a short time, he had an argument with the Arab and left without collecting his pay. He found another clerk's job, but it paid much less. He was too proud to ask his father for help or admit that he had been wrong. Nevertheless, word got back to Onyango, and when Barak came home for a visit, his father shouted to him that he would amount to nothing. Barak tried to tell Onyango that the new job paid much better than the one Onyango had arranged. He said that he was earning 150 shillings every month. Onyango knew that his son had lied. He went into his hut and told Barak to go away because he had brought shame on his father. Barak moved to Nairobi and found a job working as a clerk for the railway, but he was bored, and he became distracted by the politics of the country. The Kikuyu had begun their warfare in the forests. Everywhere there were rallies calling for Kenyatta's release from prison. Barak began to attend political meetings after work and came to know some of the KANU leadership. At one of these meetings, the police came, and Barak was arrested for violating the meeting law. He was jailed and sent word to his father that he needed money for bail. But Onyango refused to give Barak the money that he asked for and told me that his son needed to learn his lesson well. Because he was not a leader in KANU, Barak was released after a few days. But there was no happiness in his release, for he had begun to think that perhaps what his father had said was true, that he would amount to nothing. He was a man of 20, and what did he have? He had been fired from his railway job, he was estranged from his father, without money or prospects, and he now had a wife and child. He had met Kazia when he was only 18. She lived in Kindu with her family then. He was struck by her beauty, and after a brief courtship, he decided that he would marry her. To do so, he knew that his father would have to help him with the dowry, and so he asked me to intercede on his behalf. 1 year after Barak and Kazia were married, Roy was born. 2 years later came Alma. To support this family, Barak had to take any work he could find, and he finally convinced another Arab, named Suleiman, to take him on as an office boy. But Barak remained deeply depressed, almost desperate. Barak saw that he might end up working as the clerk of these men for the rest of his life. Then good fortune struck, in the form of two American women. They were teaching in Nairobi, connected to some religious organization, and one day they came into the office where Barak was working. Your father struck up a conversation with them, and soon these women became his friends. They loaned him books to read and invited him to their house, and when they saw how smart he was, they told him that he should go to a university. He explained that he had no money and no secondary school certificate, but these women said they could arrange for him to take a correspondence course that would give him the certificate he needed. If he was successful, they said, they would try to help him get into a university in America. Barak became very excited and immediately rode away for this correspondence course. For the first time in his life, he worked diligently. Every night and during his lunch hours, he would study his books and do the lessons in his notebooks. A few months later, he sat for the exam at the American Embassy. The exam took several months to score, and during this wait, he was so nervous he could barely eat. He became so thin that we all thought he would die. Then one day, the letter came. I was not there to see him open it. I know that when he told me the news, he was still shouting with happiness. He still had no money, though, and no university had yet accepted him. Onyango had softened towards his son when he saw that he was becoming more responsible, but even he could not raise the money to pay university fees and transport abroad. So Barak wrote to the universities in America. He wrote and he wrote. Finally, a university in Hawaii wrote back and told him that they would give him a scholarship. No one knew where this place was, but Barak didn't care. He gathered up his pregnant wife and son and dropped them off with me, and in less than a month he was gone. What happened in America, I cannot say. I know that after less than 2 years, we received a letter from Barak saying that he had met this American girl, Anne, and that he would like to marry her. Now, Barry, I know that you have heard that your grandfather disapproved of this marriage. This is true, but it is not for the reasons you say. You see, Onyango did not believe your father was behaving responsibly. He wrote back to Barak saying, "How can you marry this white woman when you have responsibilities at home? Will this woman return with you and live as a Luo woman? Will she accept that you already have a wife and children? I have not heard of white people understanding such things. Their women are jealous and used to being pampered. But if I am wrong in this matter, let the girl's father come to my hut and discuss the situation properly. For this is the affair of elders, not children." He also wrote to your grandfather, Stanley, and said many of these same things. As you know, your father went ahead with the marriage. He only told Onyango what had happened after you were born. We are all happy that this marriage took place, because without it, we would not have you with us here now. But your grandfather was very angry at the time, and threatened to have Barak's visa revoked. And because he had lived with white people, perhaps Onyango did understand the white people's customs, better than Barak did. For when Barak finally returned to Kenya, we discovered that you and your mother had stayed behind, just as Onyango had warned. Soon after Barak came, a white woman arrived in Kisumu looking for him. At first, we thought this must be your mother, Anne. Barak had to explain that this was a different woman, Ruth. He said that he had met her at Harvard and that she had followed him to Kenya without his knowledge. I know that once Barak agreed to marry Ruth, she could not accept the idea of having Kazia as a second wife. That is how the children went to live with their father and his new wife in Nairobi. When Barak brought Roy and Alma back to visit, Ruth would have refused to accompany him and would not let Barak bring David or Mark. The others have told you what happened to your father in Nairobi. We saw him rarely, and he would usually stay only for a short time. Whenever he came, he would bring us expensive gifts and money and impress all the people with his big car and fine clothes. But your grandfather continued to speak harshly to him, as if he were a boy. Onyango was now very old. He walked with a cane and was almost blind. He could not even bathe without my help, which I think caused him shame. But age did not soften his temper. Later, when Barak fell from power, he would try to hide his problems from the old man. He continued to bring gifts that he could no longer afford, although we noticed that he arrived in a taxi instead of his own car. Only to me would he confide his unhappiness and disappointments. I would tell him he was too stubborn in his dealings with the government. He would talk to me about principles, and I would tell him that his principles weighed too heavily on his children. He would say I didn't understand, just as his father had said to me. So I stopped giving advice and just listened. That is what Barak needed most, I think, someone to listen to him. Even after things had improved again for him, and he had built this house for us, he remained heavy-hearted. With his children, he behaved just as Onyango had behaved towards him. He saw that he was pushing them away, but there was nothing he could do. He still liked to boast and laugh and drink with the men, but his laughter was empty. I remember the last time he visited Onyango before the old man died. The two of them sat in their chairs, facing each other and eating their food, but no words passed between them. A few months later, when Onyango finally went to join his ancestors, Barak came home to make all the arrangements. He said very little, and it's only when he sorted through a few of the old man's belongings that I saw him begin to weep. I asked Granny if she had anything left of the old man's or our grandfather's. She went into her bedroom, sorting through the contents of an old leather trunk. A few minutes later, she emerged with a rust-colored book the size of a passport, along with a few papers of different colors, stapled together and chewed at an angle along one side. "I'm afraid this is all I could find," she said to Alma. "The rats got to the papers before I had a chance to put them away." Alma and I sat down and set the book and papers on the low table in front of us. The binding on the red book had crumbled away, but the cover was still legible. "Domestic Servants Pocket Register," it read. And in small letters, "Issued under the authority of the Registration of Domestic Servants Ordinance, 1928, Colony and Protectorate of Kenya." On the book's inside cover, we found a 2-shilling stamp above Onyango's left and right thumbprints. The swirls were still clear, like an imprint of coral. The box was empty, where the photograph once had been. The preamble explained, "The objective of this ordinance is to provide every person employed in a domestic capacity with a record of such employment, and to safeguard his or her interests, as well as to protect employers against the employment of persons who have rendered themselves unsuitable for such work." The term of servant was defined: cook, house servant, waiter, butler, nurse, valet, barboy, footman, or chauffeur, or washerman. The rules governing the carrying of such passbooks: servants found to be working without such books, or in any way injuring such books, are liable to a fine not exceeding 100 shillings or to imprisonment not exceeding 6 months or to both. And then, the particulars of said registered servant, filled out in the elegant, unhurried script of a nameless clerk. Name, Hussein Onyango. Native Registration Ordinance Number RWLA Nairobi 0976717. Race or Tribe: Jaluo. Usual Place of Residence when not employed: Kisumu. Sex: Male. Age: 35. Height and build: 6 foot medium. Complexion: dark. Nose: flat. Mouth: large. Hair: curly. Teeth: 6 missing. Scars, tribal marks, or other peculiarities: none. Toward the back of the book, we found the particulars of employment signed and testified to by various employers. Captain C. Harford of Nairobi's Government House said that Onyango performed his duties as a personal boy with admirable diligence. Mr. A. G. Dixon found his cooking excellent. He can read and write English and follows any recipes. Apart from other things, his pastries are excellent. He no longer needed Onyango's services since, quote, "I'm no longer on safari." Dr. H. H. Sherry suggested that Onyango is a capable cook, but the job is not big enough for him. On the other hand, Mr. Arthur W. H. Cole of the East Africa Survey Group said that after a week on the job, Onyango was found to be unsuitable and certainly not worth 60 shillings per month. We moved to the stack of letters. They were from our father, addressed to various universities in the States. There were more than 30 of them, to the presidents of Morgan State, Santa Barbara Junior College, San Francisco State. "Dear President Calhoun," one letter began, "I have heard of your college from Mrs. Helen Roberts of Palo Alto, California, who is now in Nairobi here. Mrs. Roberts, knowing how much desirous I am to further my studies in the United States of America, has asked me to apply to your esteemed college for admission. I shall therefore be very much pleased if you will kindly forward to me your application form and information regarding the possibility of such scholarships as you may be aware of." Attached to several letters were recommendations from Miss Elizabeth Mooney, a literacy specialist from Maryland. "It is not possible to obtain Mr. Obama's school transcripts," she wrote, "since he has been out of school for some years. However, Miss Mooney expressed confidence in our father's talents, noting that she had observed him making use of algebra and geometry. She added that there was a great need in Kenya for capable and dedicated teachers, and that, given Mr. Obama's desire to be of service to his country, he should be given a chance, perhaps on a one-year basis." This was it, I thought to myself. My inheritance. I rearranged the letters in a neat stack and set them under the registry book. Then I went out into the backyard. Standing before the two graves, I felt everything around me, the cornfields, the mango tree, the sky, closing in, until I was left only with a series of mental images, Granny's stories come to life. I see my grandfather, standing before his father's hut, a wiry, grim-faced boy, almost ridiculous in his oversized trousers and his buttonless shirt. I watch his father turn away from him and hear his brother's laugh. I feel the heat pour down his brow, the knots forming in his limbs, the sudden jump in his heart. And as his figure turns and starts back down the road of red earth, I know that for him the path of his life is now altered irreversibly, completely. He will have to reinvent himself in this arid, solitary place. Through force of will, he will create a life out of the scraps of an unknown world and the memories of a world rendered obsolete. And yet, as he sits alone in a freshly scrubbed hut, an old man now with milky eyes, I know that he still hears his father and brothers laughing behind him. He still hears the clipped voice of a British captain, explaining for the third and last time the correct proportion of tonic to gin. The nerves of the old man's neck tighten, the rage builds, he grabs a stick to hit at something, anything, until finally his grip weakens, with the realization that for all the power in his hands and the force of his will, the laughter, the rebukes, will outlast him. His body goes slack in the chair. He knows he will not outlive a mocking fate. He waits to die, alone. The picture fades, replaced by the image of a 9-year-old boy, my father. He's hungry, tired, clinging to his sister's hand, searching for the mother he's lost. The hunger is too much for him, the exhaustion too great, until finally the slender line that holds him to his mother snaps, sending her image to float down, down into the emptiness. The boy starts to cry. He shakes off his sister's hand. He wants to go home, he shouts, back to his father's house. He will find a new mother. He will lose himself in games and learn the power of his mind. But he won't forget the desperation of that day. 12 years later, at his narrow desk, he will glance up from a stack of forms toward the restless sky and feel that same panic return. He too will have to invent himself. His boss is out of the office. He sets the forms aside and from an old file cabinet pulls out a list of addresses. He yanks the typewriter toward him and begins to type, letter after letter after letter, typing the envelopes, sealing the letters like messages in bottles that will drop through a post office slot into a vast ocean and perhaps allow him to escape the island of his father's shame. How lucky he must have felt when his ship came sailing in. He must have known, when that letter came from Hawaii, that he had been chosen after all, that he possessed the grace of his name, the baraka, the blessings of God. With the degree, the ascot, the American wife, the car, the words, the figures, the wallet, the proper proportion of tonic to gin, the polish, the panache, the entire thing seamless and natural, without the cobbled-together, haphazard quality of an earlier time, what could stand in his way? He had almost succeeded, in a way his own father could never have hoped for. And then, after seeming to travel so far, to discover that he had not escaped after all, to discover that he remained trapped on his father's island, with its fissures of anger and doubt and defeat, the emotions still visible beneath the surface, hot and molten and alive, like a wicked yawning mouth, and his mother gone, gone away. I dropped to the ground and swept my hand across the smooth yellow tile. "Oh, father," I cried, "there was no shame in your confusion, just as there had been no shame in your father's before you, no shame in the fear or in the fear of his father before him. There was only shame in the silence fear had produced. It was the silence that betrayed us. If it weren't for that silence, your grandfather might have told your father that he could never escape himself or recreate himself alone. Your father might have taught those same lessons to you. And you, the son, might have taught your father that this new world that was beckoning all of you involved more than just railroads and indoor toilets and irrigation ditches and gramophones, lifeless instruments that could be absorbed into the old ways. You might have told him that these instruments carried with them a dangerous power, that they demanded a different way of seeing the world, that this power could be absorbed only alongside a faith born out of hardship, a faith that wasn't new, that wasn't black or white or Christian or Muslim, but that pulsed in the heart of the first African village and the first Kansas homestead, a faith in other people. The silence killed your faith, and for lack of faith you clung to both too much and too little of your past, too much of its rigidness, its suspicions, its male cruelties, too little of the laughter in Granny's voice, the pleasures of company while herding the goats, the murmur of the market, the stories around the fire, the loyalty that could make up for a lack of airplanes or rifles, words of encouragement, an embrace, a strong, true love. For all your gifts, the quick mind, the powers of concentration, the charm, you could never forge yourself into a whole man by leaving those things behind. For a long time, I sat between the two graves and wept. When my tears were finally spent, I felt a calmness wash over me. I felt the circle finally close. I realized that who I was, what I cared about, was no longer just a matter of intellect or obligation, no longer a construct of words. I saw that my life in America, the black life, the white life, the sense of abandonment I'd felt as a boy, the frustration and hope I had witnessed in Chicago, all of it was connected with this small plot of earth an ocean away, connected by more than the accident of a name or the color of my skin. The pain I felt was my father's pain. My questions were my brother's questions. Their struggle, my birthright. A light rain began to fall, the drops tapping on the leaves above. I was about to light a cigarette when I felt a hand on my arm. I turned to find Bernard squatting beside me, trying to fit the two of us under a bent-up old umbrella. "They wanted me to see if you were okay," he said. I smiled. Yeah, I'm okay. He nodded, his eyes squinting at the clouds. He turned back to me and said, Why don't you let me have a cigarette and I will sit and smoke with you? I looked at his smooth, dark face and put the cigarette back in the box. I need to quit, I said. Come on, let's take a walk instead. We stood up and started towards the entrance to the compound. The young boy, Godfrey, was standing beside the cooking hut, one leg propped like a crane's against the mud wall. He looked at us and offered a tentative smile. Come on, Bernard said, waving to the boy. You can walk with us. And so the three of us made our way over the widening dirt road, picking at leaves that grew along the way, watching the rain blow down across the several valleys. Epilogue. I think I've learned to be more patient these past few years, with others as well as myself. If so, it's one of the several improvements in my character that I attribute to my wife, Michelle. She's a daughter of the South Side, raised in one of those bungalow-style houses that I spent so many hours visiting during my first year in Chicago. She doesn't always know what to make of me. She worries that, like Gramps and the old man, I'm something of a dreamer. Indeed, in her eminent practicality and Midwestern attitudes, she reminds me not a little of Toot. I remember how, the first time I took her back to Hawaii, Gramps nudged my ribs and said Michelle was quite a looker. Toot, on the other hand, described my bride-to-be as a very sensible girl, which Michelle understood to be my grandmother's highest form of praise. After our engagement, I took Michelle to Kenya to meet the other half of my family. She was an immediate success there as well, in part because the number of Luo words in her vocabulary very soon surpassed my own. We had a fine time in Alego, helping Alma on a film project of hers, listening to more of Granny's stories, meeting relatives I'd missed the first time around. Away from the countryside, though, life in Kenya seemed to have gotten harder. The economy had worsened, with a corresponding rise in corruption and street crime. The case of the old man's inheritance remained unresolved, and Sarah and Kazia were still not on speaking terms. Neither Bernard or Abo or Said had yet found steady work, although they remained hopeful. They were talking about learning how to drive, perhaps purchasing a used matatu together. There were deaths that year. Michelle's father, as good and decent a man as I've ever known, died before he could give his daughter away. Gramps died a few months later, after a prolonged bout with prostate cancer. Despite these heartaches, Michelle and I decided to go ahead with our wedding plans. Reverend Jeremiah A. Wright Jr. performed the service in the sanctuary of Trinity United Church of Christ on 95th and Parnell. Everyone looked very fine at my reception, my new aunts admiring the cake, my new uncles admiring themselves in their rented tuxedos. I watched Maya, politely fending off the advances of some brothers who thought they were slick but who were, in fact, much too old for and should have known better. But when I started to grumble, Michelle told me to relax. My little sister could handle herself. Michelle was right, of course. I looked at my baby sister and saw a full-grown woman now, beautiful and wise and looking like a Latin countess with her olive skin and long black hair and black bridesmaid's gown. Aoma was standing beside her, looking just as lovely, although her eyes were a little puffy. To my surprise, she was the only one who cried during the ceremony. When the band started to play, the two of them sought out the protection of Michelle's 5 and 6-year-old cousins, who impressively served as our official ring bearers. Watching the boys somberly lead my sisters out onto the dance floor, I thought they looked like young African princes in their little kente cloth caps and matching cummerbunds and wilted bow ties. The person who made me proudest of all, though, was Roy. Actually, now we call him Abongo, his Luo name. For 2 years ago, he decided to reassert his African heritage. He converted to Islam and has sworn off pork and tobacco and alcohol. He still works at his accounting firm, but talks about moving back to Kenya once he has enough money. In fact, when we saw each other in Home Squared, he was busy building a hut for himself and his mother, away from our grandfather's compound, in accordance with Luo tradition. Abongo's new lifestyle has left him lean and clear-eyed. And at the wedding, he looked so dignified in his black African gown with white trim and matching cap that some of our guests mistook him for my father. He was certainly the older brother that day, talking me through prenuptial jitters, patiently telling me for the fifth and sixth time that yes, he still had the ring, nudging me out the door with the observation that if I spent any more time in front of the mirror, it wouldn't matter how I looked because we were sure to be late. Toward the end of the wedding, I watched him grinning widely for the video camera, his long arms draped over the shoulders of my mother and Toot, whose heads barely reached the height of his chest. "Hey, brother," he said to me as I walked up to the three of them. "It looks like I have two new mothers now." Toot patted him on the back. "And we have a new son," she said, although when she tried to say a bongo, her Kansas tongue mangled it hopelessly. My mother's chin started to tremble again, and Abongo lifted up his glass of fruit punch for a toast. "To those who are not here with us," he said. "And to a happy ending," I said. We dribbled our drinks onto the checker-tiled floor, and for that moment at least, I felt like the luckiest man alive.
The next senator from the state of Illinois, Barack Obama. Thank you so much. Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Dick Durbin. You make us all proud. On behalf of the great state of Illinois, crossroads of a nation, land of Lincoln, let me express my deepest gratitude for the privilege of addressing this convention. Tonight is a particular honor for me because, let's face it, my presence on this stage is pretty unlikely. My father was a foreign student, born and raised in a small village in Kenya. He grew up herding goats, went to school in a tin roof shack. His father, my grandfather, was a cook, a domestic servant to the British. But my grandfather had larger dreams for his son. Through hard work and perseverance, my father got a scholarship to study in a magical place, America, that shone as a beacon of freedom and opportunity to so many who had come before. While studying here, my father met my mother. She was born in a town on the other side of the world, in Kansas. Her father worked on oil rigs and farms through most of the Depression. The day after Pearl Harbor, my grandfather signed up for duty, joined Patton's army, marched across Europe. Back home, my grandmother raised a baby and went to work on a bomber assembly line. After the war, they studied on the GI Bill, bought a house through FHA, and later moved west, all the way to Hawaii in search of opportunity. And they, too, had big dreams for their daughter. A common dream born of two continents. My parents shared not only an improbable love, they shared an abiding faith in the possibilities of this nation. They would give me an African name, Barack, or Blessed, believing that in a tolerant America, your name is no barrier to success. They imagined me going to the best schools in the land, even though they weren't rich, because in a generous America, you don't have to be rich to achieve your potential. They're both passed away now, And yet I know that on this night, they look down on me with great pride. They stand here, and I stand here today, grateful for the diversity of my heritage, aware that my parents' dreams live on in my two precious daughters. I stand here knowing that my story is part of the larger American story, that I owe a debt to all of those who came before me, and that in no other country on earth is my story even possible. Tonight, we gather to affirm the greatness of our nation. Not because of the height of our skyscrapers, or the power of our military, or the size of our economy. Our pride is based on a very simple premise, summed up in a declaration made over 200 years ago. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That is the true genius of America. A faith in simple dreams, an insistence on small miracles, that we can tuck in our children at night and know that they are fed and clothed and safe from harm, that we can say what we think, write what we think without hearing a sudden knock on the door, that we can have an idea and start our own business without paying a bribe, that we can participate in the political process without fear of retribution, and that our votes will be counted, at least most of the time. This year, in this election, we are called to reaffirm our values and our commitments, to hold them against a hard reality, and see how we're measuring up to the legacy of our forebears and the promise of future generations. And fellow Americans, Democrats, Republicans, Independents, I say to you tonight, we have more work to do. More work to do for the workers I met in Galesburg, Illinois, who are losing their union jobs at the Maytag plant that's moving to Mexico, and now are having to compete with their own children for jobs that pay $7 an hour. More to do for the father that I met who was losing his job and choking back the tears, wondering how he would pay $4,500 a month for the drugs his son needs without the health benefits that he counted on. More to do for the young woman in East St. Louis, and thousands more like her, who has the grades, has the drive, has the will, but doesn't have the money to go to college. Now, don't get me wrong. The people I meet in small towns and big cities, in diners and office parks, they don't expect government to solve all their problems. They know they have to work hard to get ahead, and they want to. Go into the collar counties around Chicago, and people will tell you they don't want their tax money wasted by a welfare agency or by the Pentagon. Go into any inner city neighborhood, and folks will tell you that government alone can't teach our kids to learn. They know that parents have to teach, that children can't achieve unless we raise their expectations and turn off the television sets and eradicate the slander that says a black youth with a book is acting white. They know those things. People don't expect government to solve all their problems. But they sense deep in their bones that with just a slight change in priorities, we can make sure that every child in America has a decent shot at life, and that the doors of opportunity remain open to all. They know we can do better, and they want that choice. In this election, we offer that choice. Our party has chosen a man to lead us who embodies the best this country has to offer, and that man is John Kerry. John Kerry understands the ideals of community, faith, and service because they've defined his life. From his heroic service to Vietnam, to his years as a prosecutor and lieutenant governor, through two decades in the United States Senate, he's devoted himself to this country. Again and again, we've seen him make tough choices when easier ones were available. His values and his record affirm what is best in us. John Kerry believes in an America where hard work is rewarded. So instead of offering tax breaks to companies shipping jobs overseas, he offers them to companies creating jobs here at home. John Kerry believes in an America where all Americans can afford the same health coverage our politicians in Washington have for themselves. John Kerry believes in energy independence, so we aren't held hostage to the profits of oil companies or the sabotage of foreign oil fields. John Kerry believes in the constitutional freedoms that have made our country the envy of the world, and he will never sacrifice our basic liberties, nor use faith as a wedge to divide us. And John Kerry believes that in a dangerous world, war must be an option sometimes, but it should never be the first option. You know, a while back, I met a young man named Seamus in a VFW hall in East Moline, Illinois. He was a good-looking kid, 6'2", 6'3", clear-eyed with an easy smile. He told me he joined the Marines and was heading to Iraq the following week. And as I listened to him explain why he'd enlisted, the absolute faith he had in our country and its leaders, his devotion to duty and service, I thought, this young man was all that any of us might ever hope for in a child. But then I asked myself, are we serving Seamus as well as he's serving us? I thought of the 900 men and women, sons and daughters, husbands and wives, friends and neighbors who won't be returning to their own hometowns. I thought of the families I'd met who were struggling to get by without a loved one's full income, or whose loved ones had returned with a limb missing or nerves shattered, but still lacked long-term health benefits because they were reservists. When we send our young men and women into harm's way, we have a solemn obligation not to fudge the numbers or shade the truth about why they are going, to care for their families while they're gone, to tend to the soldiers upon their return, and to never, ever go to war without enough troops to win the war, secure the peace, and earn the respect of the world. Now, let me be clear. We have real enemies in the world. These enemies must be found, they must be pursued, and they must be defeated. John Kerry knows this. And just as Lieutenant Kerry did not hesitate to risk his life to protect the men who served with him in Vietnam, President Kerry will not hesitate one moment to use our military might to keep America safe and secure. John Kerry believes in America, and he knows that it's not enough for just some of us to prosper. For alongside our famous individualism, there's another ingredient in the American saga, a belief that we're all connected as one people. If there is a child on the south side of Chicago who can't read, that matters to me even if it's not my child. If there's a senior citizen somewhere who can't pay for their prescription drugs and having to choose between medicine and the rent, that makes my life poorer even if it's not my grandparent. If there's an Arab American family being rounded up without benefit of an attorney or due process, that threatens my civil liberties. It is that fundamental belief, I am my brother's keeper, I am my sister's keeper, that makes this country work. It's what allows us to pursue our individual dreams and yet still come together as one American family. E pluribus unum, out of many, one. Now, even as we speak, there are those who are preparing to divide us, the spin masters, the negative ad peddlers, who embrace the politics of anything goes. Well, I say to them tonight, there is not a liberal America and a conservative America. There is the United States of America. There is not a black America and a white America and Latino America and Asian America. There's the United States of America. The pundits like to slice and dice our country into red states and blue states. Red states for Republicans, blue states for Democrats. But I've got news for them too. We worship an awesome God in the blue states, and we don't like federal agents poking around in our libraries in the red states. We coach Little League in the blue states, and yes, we've got some gay friends in the red states. There are patriots who oppose the war in Iraq, and they're patriots who supported the war in Iraq. We are one people, all of us pledging allegiance to the Stars and Stripes, all of us defending the United States of America. In the end, that's what this election is about. Do we participate in a politics of cynicism, or do we participate in a politics of hope? John Kerry calls on us to hope. John Edwards calls on us to hope. I'm not talking about blind optimism here, the almost willful ignorance that thinks unemployment will go away if we just don't think about it, or healthcare crisis will solve itself if we just ignore it. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about something more substantial. It's the hope of slaves sitting around a fire singing freedom songs. The hope of immigrants setting out for distant shores. The hope of a young naval lieutenant bravely patrolling the Mekong Delta. The hope of a mill worker's son who dares to defy the odds. The hope of a skinny kid with a funny name who believes that America has a place for him too. In the face of difficulty, hope in the face of uncertainty, the audacity of hope. In the end, that is God's greatest gift to us, the bedrock of this nation, a belief in things not seen, a belief that there are better days ahead. I believe that we can give our middle class relief and provide working families with a road to opportunity. I believe we can provide jobs to the jobless, homes to the homeless, and reclaim young people in cities across America from violence and despair. I believe that we have a righteous wind at our backs, and that as we stand on the crossroads of history, we can make the right choices and meet the challenges that face us. America, tonight, if you feel the same energy that I do, if you feel the same urgency that I do, if you feel the same passion that I do, if you feel the same hopefulness that I do, if we do what we must do, then I have no doubt that all across the country, from Florida to Oregon, from Washington to Maine, the people will rise up in November, and John Kerry will be sworn in as president, and John Edwards will be sworn in as vice president, and this country will reclaim its promise, and out of this long political darkness, a brighter day will come. Thank you very much, everybody. God bless you.
We hope you have enjoyed this production of Dreams from My Father, a story of race and inheritance, by Barack Obama. This program was produced by Jacob Bronstein and directed by Jacob Bronstein and Brian Smith. Text copyright 1995, 2004, by Barack Obama. Production copyright 2005, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.